You're listening to Red Center, your roundup of Red Camera news from the crew at fxguide.com.
G'day and welcome to episode 6 of Red Center. Thanks for joining us. And Jason.
Hey Mike.
How are you?
I'm very well.
I took a week off.
You did. I know, because there was no tweets. Twitter went black.
Blank. Yeah, no, I was in New Zealand doing training, which was good, and but I'm back now, and we're recording this. Me being up since 4 a.m. So,
no, very good. It's always good if you've been up late or haven't had much sleep. I think we get a much better podcast out.
That is point in fact. So we have a good show for you this week. In fact, we have a cracker of a show for you this week. We're actually going to be doing not one, but two interviews this week, as well as our regular news updates on what's shipping and what's happening. And the two interviews we have this week, one by myself and one by you, Jace. The first one I'm going to look at is the Nikon lenses, with some help from Steve Sherrick in America.
Yeah, that sounds fantastic.
Oh, yeah, no, totally. And I've been just dying to actually get one-on-one with somebody that's been shooting properly with Nikon lenses on their Red camera. So that's something I was quite genuinely would have been happy to discuss had I not even been doing Red Center. And then you caught up with some really amazing guys as well.
Yeah, the guys at Silverado Systems in the States, who are running this really interesting, I guess you call it, project for opencut.org is what it is. I guess it's open source editing for Red footage. They've got basically shot an entire film, and you can you get a chance to get your hands on the footage and cut it and send them back a film and win a prize. It's really
people have been blogging me, emailing me, and twittering me about this, saying, "Do you know about this?" And I was glad to be able to say yes, know all about it. Jason has interviewed them. Having said that, I actually don't fully understand it myself. I was just sort of, you know, assuming that you did. So maybe you can explain it to me when we get to that, because I'm slightly confused about the nature of it. So that's all coming up later in the show.
Yep.
But right now we should start with our rundown of what's going on. And we have about five major things to cover before we get to the interviews. And the first of them is that Build 16's gone into alpha, which is really good news.
So what does that mean, Mike, going into alpha? I guess there's a select people out there who get to test it and give their feedback back to Red before it goes to beta.
Yeah, there's a sort of fairly irreversible process of installing Build 16. So obviously, if you put it out to public beta and everyone installed it and they discovered that it, you know, had a major problem, that would cause an enormous amount of users to have an enormous amount of grief. So they're trying to get it right, and they've been obviously slightly delayed. They hope to have it out around NAB time. So everyone is, I guess, keen to get their hands on it, but by the same token, it's as keen as you are to get your hands on it, would be a shame to get your hands on it only to discover that it had some major flaw in your footage and it wouldn't actually work for you, and then of course your camera would be hard to be used. So as stuff is published on Build 16, we'll cover that, and we'll probably cover it more next week, as the build of alpha is only just out, and we have to be careful is what we say. But in fact, we've been talking to users a lot, haven't we, Jason?
We have been talking to some users. Of interest, there's been some very varied comments, good and bad, and one of them is that perhaps we should be a little bit more structured.
And I wasn't talking about that. I was completely ignoring that.
Oh, okay.
No, I'm very comfortable with my I'm very comfortable with my sexuality. Thank you. I don't need to be told to go do anything. But I am actually referring to the fact that that both here in Sydney and in New Zealand, we've had two events. One, Australian-based or Sydney-based informal Red users group gathering, and another one just. Was it? God, was it last night? It was last night in New Zealand.
Which is about 5 years ago.
It feels like five years ago, because I'm now in Sydney. But so you were at the Sydney event. I thought it went really well. I thought it was
really
good.
Yeah, look, it was fantastic. We set up Red, your Red number 22, by looking out the beautiful Sydney Harbour. As the sun went down, shot some footage. Everyone had a bit of a chance to have a play with the camera. If they, it's people are quite tentative around the camera. It's quite funny. It's almost like when a Red gets unboxed or, you know, put on a tripod. It's almost like there's a bit of royalty in the room or something. It seems quite people sort of almost a bit sort of afraid to touch the thing. But we shot some stuff as the sun went down and into night, and then we put it on the scratch system that they were demonstrating, and had a bit of a play with the footage. So it was great. And obviously you did a great presentation.
We ran through some stuff that we'd covered in Vegas. Actually, Steve, who we're talking to about the Nikon lens, actually set up, or was one of the key members of setting up the Las Vegas user group meeting. So that was great. We also had a video from Ted from the set of the Not To Be Named show that he was on in New York, which was with Red Cameras.
That was really cool to sort of, you know, have all these people sit down, and there's this wonderful personal message up on the screen from Ted himself talking to us. That was really nice. It was it was good for him to go to the trouble of doing that.
I think one of the things that people were really interested to see is we had a real-time version of Scratch running. So we had Scratch running on the Digistore, and I've got a funny story about that when we got to New Zealand, but in the Sydney one, we just had it running 24 frames a second, real-time 2K, which was really nice to see, because obviously Scratch has been able to do 2K before, but it's been 2K of DPX files. This is decoding RED files in full resolution 2K, and that obviously allows it to work like a virtual telecine. So that was really cool, with grades and secondaries.
So, yeah, I sort of missed a little step, but from what it looked like, we were basically just taking the CF card straight out of the camera and just putting it straight in there.
Yeah, so we were doing that, and we were doing stuff off the drive. And the pivotal thing is that you're getting the stuff off the raw R3D files and then applying LUTs to it, depending on which color space you want to work in. We were looking and discussing both logarithmic and Rec 709. And what it took to work in gamma video or log space, and then grading it and zooming it and playing with it all in real time and being able to play it out at full 24 frames a second guaranteed. So that was good. But I've got to tell you this funny story. So I went over to New Zealand and I was doing some training over there, and it was great in Wellington. And then I went up to Auckland to do the actual user group thing, and some great friends. Helped us out there, and we went out and shot some stuff over in actually the beach that they used for the piano, but I digress. So we did that, and while this was going on, the guys had organized to give us the Scratch real-time system, took it over to show somebody, and those guys had a play with it. So I sat down like seconds before I was meant to sort of start to just check everything was in its place to discover everything had moved, right? And I'm like, what's the deal? And the guy who was helping us, great guy, Pat, was like, oh yeah, I forgot to mention, I let some guys play with it. And so they'd taken it off running at 24 frames a second and had it in free run. So it was running like, 30. And on 2K stuff, it seemed to be running like 70 frames a second, right? And so it wasn't a problem of it not running at 24 frames a second. It was actually running over speed on some clips until I could work out what was going on. So I sort of put stuff down to play it, and suddenly everybody's like flying around the screen, which, it's great that you've got an overperforming box, but I must admit it was quite disconcerting to be like, I should have allowed more time to check it, but I prepped it here in Sydney before it flew over. I just missed the step of somebody playing with the settings.
It was working fine when I left home.
Exactly. But that's fine. Anyway, it was great, and the turnout in New Zealand was phenomenal. We had like 60 or...
Wow, that's amazing.
Yeah, no, it's really, really good. They did a great job there.
And you had four reds?
Actually, we only had one red in the end, because we were in the we could have had a whole bunch of reds, but we weren't going to do a lot of filming there because we were in an auditorium, as it turned out. So we had one red that I could just stand around and discuss, and we did live stuff with the 2K projector they had there and stuff. So it was all really, really good, and Red Rocket really looked after us, and we thanked those guys for our time in Auckland. It was great.
Yeah, they're fantastic. I used them when I was down there shooting.
They said to say hi.
They are really, because it was probably it was a few months ago. It was probably only the second or third sort of gig they'd done on Red, and they hadn't had the cameras very long, but they were switched on, so I'm sure they're all the more so.
Now, I wonder if it was your influence or not. Those guys had the the eyepiece Element Technica eyepiece thing set up for it. Which looked really nice, actually.
Yeah, no, I think even when we shot it, we didn't even have viewfinders. We just had didn't even have the proper Red EVFs. We had, all third-party stuff.
Well, they certainly pimped up their Red, and we'll actually be coming to our regular section on pimping your Red in a section. But before we do that, let's discuss where we are in Red World. What's shipping, Jace? What's the state of the art?
Exactly the same as where it was last time, I'm afraid. If you're ordering now, or if you're sort of last in the queue there, around the 4,000 mark, you're still going to get yours in November. Still sitting there shipping up to the 2,000 mark. I think I spoke to somebody who was about to get their camera that was like 1990 or something. They were in the late 1900s, so I'm sure soon it'll kick over into that 2000 mark there. Red drives are shipping. The LCDs, there's plenty of them. The smaller LCDs. The larger LCDs, I think, are still a bit of a back order for that. 18-50 lenses, metrics, 50 to 150 Imperials. I think there's a delay of 1 month. This is all just coming straight off recon from Jim. And the Nikon mounts are shipping, which obviously we'll come to that a little bit later with our interview with Steve.
I got to say, I mean, no disrespect to the Red community, but you doing that saves me going on to Red Crack and RedUser.net. And I must admit, it's hard to sometimes get the info for the noise level, so
yeah,
it's great.
It's a little bit slow at the moment, I must say. It sounds crazy because I'm sure at Red it's the absolute opposite. They're running around with their chooks with their heads cut off.
So, and anything else on Red itself?
They are not going to make the go-ahead with the Red matte box that everyone was really keen on seeing, the sort of beautiful-looking carbon fibre thing. It does seem a little bit silly. Petrov, Red Rot Micro, the Crozure that you've got. There's plenty of people making matte boxes. Wise choice, get on with making the other stuff and getting the other cameras out the door.
Did we discuss the fact that they were going to not make the Red data option that they were always going to make that put RAW out the side of the camera?
No.
Because that was something that I think got killed at NAB that no one really discussed, and I kind of assumed everybody knew it, but I'm not a big super RAW fan, because I always said that would require us to have such huge amounts of discs cabled off the Red that would make it an unpopular move. And I think, you know, the Red codec R3D is just so brilliant that I much prefer to see that R&D going elsewhere. But you know, the whole idea of not having the CF card reader on the side and actually having a big data port.
How could you possibly capture all that stuff though anyway?
Yeah, I mean, I guess it's the same problem we had when we were looking at getting 4K playback for, you know, these events, for example. Like, full 4K playback is a huge data problem. Getting screens that can handle it, there are so few screens that can handle the kind of data. It's, you know, which I guess is why Red Ray is such a significant product. This whole idea of, you know, being able to take any footage, even if it isn't a Red project, but it's at 4K, encoded into a new codec as yet unseen, that's at the 6 to 8 megabit, and then put it on a normal DVD-R or whatever, and play it on your Red Ray, so you can actually play 4K off a sub $1,000 box. Because right now, playing 4K is just a non-trivial task, and recording it, as you say, from a RAW port would be a non-trivial task, and one that would kind of set the movement back a bit, I think.
When the compression's so good, you've got great sort of image, and you know it's going to obviously be something that's going to evolve again. The compression's going to get better, the imagery's going to get better. You know, it's all the more pointless to sort of start going back to the. When there is so much raw data in this, you know, I suppose I call it compressed file, I suppose.
Well, I mean, it is compressed, but, you know, the thing you got to understand, like, if you think about a Bayer pattern, right, even if all you did was just take the Bayer pattern is one 4K panel. If you were in RGB space, it would be three 4Ks. Does that make sense? So right away, the Bayer pattern is one third, even before you do anything clever. Just taking the data at the sensor level, it's one third already. And then all you have to do is do some data handling stuff to get the data down. Not, I say all you have to do. I mean, obviously, they've done a heck of a lot to get it to where it is. But, like, there are some real advantages of trying to not compress an image based on image content, but actually compress a data off a sensor, which is all, you know, let's face it, just in a different mathematical form than it is when it turns into a picture.
Yeah, when it's compressing it, it's not actually looking at the image. It's not compressing it based on movement or all that sort of stuff. It's actually just doing it a different way.
Yeah. Hey, I've already gone off my running sheet because I've skipped over our winner from last week's app. If you remember, last week we had a competition to win a small accessory to pimp your camera, and it was won by Brian Timmons. And Brian actually emailed me. I never win these things normally. And he was the first one to correctly send in the answer, dynamic range extension. A few people sent in the correct answers and just weren't first, and we're sorry about that. But somebody suggested that the next competition we have, to make it even fairer, which we will do at the end of this week's podcast, will be to take the 10th correct caller, as it were. Does that make sense?
Well, how does that make a difference?
Well, it makes a difference because if your time zone challenged on when we publish it,
right? Yes.
And you think, well, somebody must have already won this because I just woke up and it's already up.
Yes, gotcha.
Then
yes.
You're not guaranteed that you don't have to be sort of sitting there getting refresh. Yes. Not that they know when it's coming, but
makes sense. But you've also got to know the question.
The question, which we will give you at the end of this podcast.
Yep. Okay. And be smart enough to get the answer right. Okay.
So what have you got, Jace, in the pimping department?
In the pimping department, I've got a really cool handles. I'm a little bit, no offence to Red, all of this, entire podcast should be sort of asterisk with no offence to Red, we love Red, but I'm not a fan of the Red handles. Okay, they're a little bit sort of kludgy for me, it's a little bit sort of fiddly, I'm not entirely a big fan.
Well, they slip.
Well, nowadays, they probably don't slip now with the new engineering, maybe. But yes, don't they?
Okay. I don't know. I've.
You want handles to be absolutely rock solid. You know, you're throwing this camera around, even though it's a fairly lightweight thing. There's a lot of force going into that, and if you're running, you want them to be rock solid. So I found this sort of interesting package on a Red user from a company called UGrip. I think they're in Germany, and they have lots of different packages of handles, and they also make this really interesting, like a little cradle to you can put wireless mic receivers in it or your Red drive in it. So they have a Red, something called, I think it's called the Diamond Red, or essentially they have a package for Red, which is handles, an extension bars for the handles, and this, I guess, this cradle for the Red drive, and it looks really beautifully made. Looks really adjustable, and it looks like when it's adjusted, it stays there. Now, I'll put a couple of links in the show notes to some people have posted some photos of their kit, and it does look really great, and they've all sort of got some good things to say about it. And it's about $1,500 for the whole package, which I think is fantastic. And the handles look really comfortable. They look extremely adjustable.
Now we saw a thing to put a controller, like a stop-start controller, which was Fear Factor?
View Factor?
Would that fit on this, do you reckon, or was it just...
They've got a little bracket for their handles to be able to put little zoom controllers and things on, so you probably could adapt it to work with this, because obviously the View Factor people have designed their little thing to go on the Red handle, so maybe they should look at this sort of stuff as well and see if they can adapt it to. That certainly looks like, if you sort of dig around a bit on the UGrip site, there looks like there's a couple of other little zoom controllers, probably more for the video kind of things, but they may well have the mounting stuff to be able to put this on the rods. Probably, maybe not on this kit, but hey, I think UGrip, if you're listening, have a chat to View Factor and get together.
So that's pretty cool, and yeah. The sort of stuff, but there's something that that I think you came across. It's probably an order of magnitude more expensive, but definitely up there in terms of way cool.
Yeah, is Box. Now I don't think these are the same people as that do the Box, like the Red Box, the computers. But these guys are in UK, and they
do they spell their name the same way?
Boxx.
Really? Isn't that how Box spells their name?
Isn't it?
If it isn't them, then I reckon someone at Box would be pretty pissed.
Maybe it is. Boxx.tv. And they have a pretty amazing microwave system. And obviously, there's a lot of this stuff's around for sort of broadcasting people. But they have HDSDI output. So high def microwave link. And they reckon it's absolutely rock solid, no drop frames, all that sort of stuff. And they've obviously designed it around the Red as well with sort of bracketing and cabling. It is not quite released yet, but if you go to...
What's that going
to
set me back if I was wanting to get into that?
It's about £2,500. So it's about $5,000 US for a transmitter. And I think the receivers go anywhere from like $3,000 US to $20,000 for a receiver. But this is, you can broadcast live from your Red, from a Steadicam or whatever in the middle of a stadium. You can go live with this thing.
I was going to say, if this is the English crowd, then they're, yeah, they're actually quite established. They're not a new company, I don't think. They've actually...
No, sure, yes. This is a new part to their business. I'm sure they've been doing microwave links and this kind of equipment for a long time, but I think that obviously they've seen a niche for this camera and adapted their gear to suit it, from what I can see.
Yeah, because if it's a company I think it is, they actually do stuff with the US networks. I think they're quite well established, the box microwave systems.
Yeah, these guys certainly know what they're doing in terms of like live links. So it's interesting. It's obviously not something just for on-set film video split sort of stuff. This is definitely, you know, full-on broadcast. But it's good. It's cool to find stuff that is designed from, you know, or adapted from the ground up to suit Red. It's pretty cool.
Yeah, no, definitely. Well, is that it? Do we have anything else?
That's it in the gear department, because we've got a lot to get on with. We've got a couple of
The one you mentioned earlier, the Nikon mount, as I said, I was really keen. Now, I got to know Steve, who we're about to cross to, from the work he was doing with the Red users in Las Vegas. So many of you will know him already. Great, great guy. And I'm going to say that not only are we going to be able to this week, say, put things in the show notes, but you'll hear at the end of the podcast, we've actually upgraded the website and upgraded the show notes and stuff. So we're no longer talking about dinky little show notes that will go away. We've actually got downloadable PDF stuff, and I'll get all to that at the end of the show,
yeah,
which means that we can actually include photos of the stuff that that Steve is talking about, which is great. And he's provided it with a bunch of images for that.
Yeah, it looks like a really great setup, and obviously he'll go through it, and I'll talk about it a bit at the end of the interview.
But I will say this, that just bear this one fact in mind, right? That just listen out when I'm talking to him about the price of what you were talking about here, right? Because like with so many of these things, there's I'm interested, and then there's what? How much does that cost? What's the website address?
Yeah.
So let's cross now to an interview I recorded earlier with Steve in America. So, Steve, thanks very much for joining us. How is it there in Boston?
Boston's great. We're actually starting to see some nice weather, although today wasn't great. But, you know, it's finally starting to turn into spring here. So always a good thing. Weather's nice. That means time to go out and do some shooting. So I'm excited.
So the last time I saw you was at the very successful Las Vegas event. You must have been pleased with how that went.
Yeah, we had a great turnout at the NAB Red User event. We had, I'd say, probably over 300 people. And, the goal being to try to get everybody into one room and go over some workflow in terms of, you know, various perspectives. You know, we've got a whole range of workflow that, you know, from the high end down to the sort of independent workflows. And I just wanted to give people an opportunity to hear from some of the people who have been dealing with that. And then also sort of a little side benefit was to have a bunch of vendors who were showing some great products. We're starting to see some things roll out in terms of Red accessories, which I'm pretty excited about, and I'm sure a lot of other Red owners are. So it was a great event, and we had a tremendous turnout.
Yeah, it was really good. So I'm interested to talk to you because you've got a interesting setup with your Red in terms of having it set for Nikon lenses. Now, obviously, you've got a wide range of experience with Red, but if I can just hit you up on your perspective from that point of view, can you start by telling us what actual lenses you have?
Sure. I'll just kind of touch on why I went the Nikon route. I actually started off with a PL mount lens, a really nice Cook Technovision 18-90 PL mount lens. But it's kind of a big, bulky lens. And for some of my own shooting, you know, in terms of going out, I like to go out and grab some stock footage and some of the smaller projects. I wanted to have just a more portable setup. So I decided to look into the Nikon option, and I've become a little bit of one of these lens freaks now, trying to acquire a bunch of different focal length primes. There's a company called RP Lens, and the owner of that company is Peter Sensor, and I had him put together a set for me, and what he does is he locates some of the AIs or AIS night cores and kind of handpicks some of the better ones. And in my set currently, I have a 24, 28, a 35, a 50, an 85, a 105. And then I've also, I've recently grabbed a 200, and I've just picked up a 17 and 35 zoom. So now, Peter, kind of building on that set.
Peter actually puts focus gears on those, right, and removes the click stops from the aperture ring. Is that right?
Absolutely, yeah. So he kind of makes them a little more cineized, you know, which has turned out to be a pretty good thing. They feel great. I mean, he really does a great job of picking out good glass, and you know, the mechanics feel pretty good too. So I would recommend, you know, anybody that is going to go that route, I mean, you can certainly, you know, scour eBay and you'll find some great lenses on there, but the nice thing is he really goes through them with a fine-tooth comb. And in fact, when I was waiting for, I believe it was the 24, he actually rejected five of the lenses that he received. They just didn't cut it for him, and I finally found one that worked out well. So it makes a big difference.
Because, of course, focus gears is a huge aspect of trying to run a lens like that that's not obviously designed for cinema work, because we're so used to focus pullers and the apparatus that goes with focus pulling. And when you go to a stills lens, I think that's a concern for many people.
Yeah, absolutely. But you know what's great is, you know, we're starting to see some other vendors now jump in, you know, like ViewFactor Studios, who are going to be coming up with tools that I think will help that out a little bit, you know, with these follow focus units that will be able to be calibrated for the still lenses. You know, they'll help out with a little bit of that focus throw and whatnot. So, I mean, you're going to have a lot of traditional things which are going to be tough for people to get by, you know, if you're not sort of offering what people are accustomed to. And I can understand that. You know, if these focus pullers, especially the ones who are working at really high levels, I mean, they got years and years of experience. It's, you know, kind of that old saying, you know, you kind of know what you know and you do it really well. And you know, to break away from that, it's going to take a little time. But, you know, I think the nice thing is that Red is such a modular camera that we're actually able to kind of pick and choose what we want to do in various circumstances. So,
who's,
you know, if I have a shoot...
So I was going to ask you, who's actual Nikon mount have you put on the front of your Red? Is it the Red one or is it a third party?
I actually have the Red one.
Okay.
I have looked at, let's see, I've got Berger Engineering, who's actually right here in Boston. They are going to eventually have a Nikon solution, but currently, I've got the Red one on there, which is actually working out great. And I know some people have been a little nervous about swapping the mounts.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that.
I got to say, I didn't have too much trouble. I think if you follow sort of the process that Doug Underdahl has laid out, you'll do okay. The key is to just make sure that you don't strip those, you know, those hex screws, because, you know, if you do that, you could run into some problems. You might have to be making a trip down to a machine shop. But I was just really careful, and, you know, kind of a little funny story. I actually had some precision hex keys, and I ended up going with a Home Depot special Husky set, which had rubber grips, which made it a little easier to grab onto and really snap those hex screws and take them out. But, you know, I think once you get the hang of that, going back and forth between the Nikon mount and the PL mount probably won't be too bad.
What about actually collimating and setting up that to be accurate for the lenses? Is it, how do you actually go about when you swap it over for making sure it's calibrated correctly?
Well, I mean, it's actually, I found so far that it's actually not too far off. You know, but I think it's a good idea to always do tests, you know, before a shoot to make sure that everything's lined up. Plus, you know, you want to make sure that you have a good lens set that you're going against. So you sort of have a reference point.
For somebody that's maybe not quite as familiar with the setup as others, a normal Nikon lens is going to be aimed at a smaller sensor size than a full sensor, because most of the Nikons don't have full sensors. Are there any aspects in terms of what Nikon lenses to use, or in terms of how it relates to the RED sensor and, you know, what it's targeting at?
From my experience so far, I'm using all of the the older 35mm versions. I have not used any of the digital versions, which I believe are made, if I'm remembering correctly, are more geared towards a digital sensor.
Yeah, so using the older ones, I guess, is both economical and good in terms of what they're actually targeted at.
Yeah, because they're meant to cover, you know, sort of that 35mm frame. And I believe that we're hitting a sweet spot with the RED sensor with those lenses. Everything that I've shot so far has been very sharp and you know, very little fall off or anything like that.
I was going to ask about fall off or vignetting or anything that.
I haven't had any issues with that. I've actually been very happy with what I've been seeing.
Now, while it would be sort of, I guess, more obvious to go for the prime is because of the fact that a prime lens is a prime lens, and you're getting, I see, some pretty fast f-stops on those primes. You've also got a zoom. How does that handle for a zoom during shot?
Well, you know, I got to be honest. I know this came up on Red User recently, and I'm not a huge fan of zooming in during a shot. Certainly, you know, the story or you know, a particular technique you may need to use a zoom, but with the 17 to 35 so far, I've been just using it basically for the variable focal length, and really haven't been doing anything in terms of zooming. But you know, from what I've been able to gather from other people, you know, they're not going to be great in terms of being able to hold through the entire zoom. They can be a little tricky, and the mechanics can be a little tough. You know, it's not as nice as, say, a cine zoom.
But I mean, on the reality of the situation, and this is speaking from a personal point of view, right? We have a zoom lens. I hardly ever can remember thinking of zooming during the shot. We nearly always just use it as a variable prime, if that makes sense.
That's you know, you're going to run into certain situations. You know, maybe it's kind of a spontaneous thing. Maybe you're doing a doc or you're doing some kind of nature shooting where, you know, all of a sudden you quickly want to zoom into something. And, you know, in those times, you may end up using that entire zoom in. But so far, I have not come across it. But, you know, where it has come up recently, I think I'll do some tests and maybe post some things to at least show what zooms I have are like in terms of what they can hold during that zoom. But in terms of the primes, I mean, they're just beautiful. I mean, so far, I've been very happy with just the look I'm getting from those.
And as far as the RED itself goes, it doesn't have any issues about those in terms of the menus or anything odd that happens. If somebody was shooting with a Nikon, it's pretty much identical, is it not?
Yeah, no, I haven't seen any oddities in that regard. As far as I can tell, I mean, you know, without doing some direct comparisons, you know, in a scene with, you know, sort of PL mounted prime versus, you know, a Nikon prime. It's almost like I don't even notice that I've got a Nikon on there. It's just, you know, I've been shooting like I normally would shoot.
And have you had a chance to compare your Nikons against the RED lenses? Because I guess in many respects, one of the things that may motivate somebody to go for a stills lens is that you can get a great set of primes for a lot less money. And I guess the only other really lower cost option for a PL mount is the RED lenses. So have you sort of seen them side by side?
I haven't. And I've got to be honest that I haven't really done any extensive tests with the RED lenses. I don't own a RED lens. And that's not at all a discredit to the RED or to RED lenses. I just didn't go that route. I picked up that Cook lens, you know, to be able to play around with the PL-mounted lenses. But my whole approach to lenses is going to be basically when a project needs a certain set of lenses, I will either, you know, rent or if they happen to want to use the lenses that I have, that's fine. But I'm going to take it on a project-by-project basis.
So I guess the other option that you have going for you is that presumably you can use screw-on lens-mounted filters. You don't need a matte box for your filters, right?
Right, that's true. Although, you know, I am leaning towards more of the matte box route, only because I like the fact that, you know, I can kind of pop filters in and out, you know, maybe a little bit quicker, and also, too, just some of the shading and whatnot of being able to control flares. And I kind of like having a matte box on the front. But, you know, the great thing is that you don't need to. I think that's the beauty of these lenses. And yeah, you mentioned the fact that they are a more affordable solution. And I think that alone is a great thing for, you know, an independent filmmaker who, you know, might be looking at the lens market right now and saying, oh, wow, I can't possibly afford to jump into this game of, you know, buying, let's say, a used set of, you know, 2.1 standards or something like that, that, you know, are running upwards of $20,000 to $25,000 right now. But well, yet, you know, you throw this Nikon mount on the camera and get a nice set of still lenses, and
I think I'm right in saying your 50 mil is like a 1.4 as well, right? So you're getting nice optical characteristics and fast and
Absolutely. I mean, it gets you to that look. I mean, it's a pretty cool thing to, for the amount of money that you'll have to invest in those lenses, it's, you know, nothing compared to what you'd have to invest in cine lenses. So.
Obviously, it's going to vary depending on what lens and where you get them, but roughly speaking, and we're not going to hold you to anything because obviously you don't speak for anyone like Peter Censor, but what's the sort of ballpark that someone should have in their head if they were after, say, a 50mm lens like Nikon that's a converted cine lens? Stills lens.
Well, you're probably going to look at, if you have some of the modifications like what Peter does, you know, you're probably talking somewhere in the area of, you know, it's funny, I don't know the exact breakdowns individually because I bought them as a set.
Right.
But I would guess, you know, at least a few $100. Yeah, and you can find the 50mm 1.4 on eBay maybe for, say, 200, 250 maybe in really good shape.
This really is a remarkable price difference, isn't it?
Oh, it's incredible. I mean, to have, you know, even if you can't go the route of having someone like Peter go through it and add some of that functionality, you know, my 200mm, which I actually posted a test on to Red User, which kind of just gave a quick illustration of slow mo and shooting a 2K, but that 200mm held up pretty well, I thought, and that was just bought off eBay for, I believe, under $200.
Well, so, get in before the price incredible. Of the old film lenses goes through the roof is my suggestion.
Yeah, I would highly recommend that even if you don't, you know, if people aren't gonna go that route, it's worth even just getting a look. You know, if you have somebody that has the Nikon on and you can play around with it, it's a lot of fun.
Well, we really appreciate you taking time to talk to us. But before we go, I do want to ask if I can. I know that I can't really get into the details, but you have a feature coming up, right?
Yes.
Can you give us a hint as to what that's about?
Yeah, we're going to be shooting that late summer, early fall. And it's what I can tell you is it's basically going to be an Iraqi war film, but a little bit of a different take. It's from the civilian contractor side. Kind of a unique story. It's going to be uniquely told. And the interesting thing from the perspective of the Red is it's going to challenge the Red quite a bit because there's a lot of low lighting scenarios. And I think that, without saying too much, without getting into too much detail, that's going to be kind of an interesting result of this film is how the Red handles it. We've already done some testing, and we're really pleased with how Red's doing so far.
Well, Steve, with your permission, we'll get in touch with you again after you finish filming to see how you got on.
Absolutely, anytime.
Thanks again so much for talking to us. Really appreciate it.
All right, great. Nice talking to you, Mike. We'll talk to you soon.
Yeah, like I think he really hit the nail on the head with those. Those lenses are a fantastic option if you want to have a really like a lightweight kit. Because obviously, not everyone wants to go out there and shoot with a whole bunch of really heavy like Cook S4s, and you know, where you need a full crew to sort of lug these cases of these things around. And of course, they cost you know like $6,000 each. You can get a fantastic small little lightweight all-in-one Pelican case of however many it's five or they've got a couple of sets, five lenses or a three lens set for like you know $3,000 in a Pelican case, all matched, all checked, takes all of the click stops out of the lenses, greases them, smooths them all out, and puts a it puts a ring on the front, an 80mm ring on the front of all of them, so they all fit onto matte box. You're not going to sort of put one on and then have to put a little adapter or a little black cloth around the matte box. Every single one of them is going to fit right in the back of a standard Arri or whatever matte box. And you know these are not obviously little, you know these aren't your little plastic Nikon you know throwaway autofocus lenses. These are you know proper manual focus you know pieces of glass, and they're beautifully sharp. And it's a real option for people that you know obviously a can't afford you know $20,000-$40,000 for a set of Cooks, well, but also don't want to lug them around.
Yeah, those lenses are really good quality lenses, and obviously they were mass produced in the day. Depending on which lens you buy, when you buy, you know when it was made. But the point is mass produced, so the price comes down. They're computer engineered for the actual optics, so they're good.
And yeah.
Now they may not work as a zoom. But I mean, how often do you? I mean, let's just discuss that for a second. Like in a job, sort of realistically speaking, I mean, when is it for you sort of creatively valid to actually be zooming during the shot?
Very rarely. It's a bit daggy, really.
But I mean, would it be just that you're trying to get that look of the 70s kind of cop show? Or?
Exactly right. If you're doing, I did a whole bunch the other day, and it was like we probably did 20 zooms in the one show, in the one sort of spot, just because we were doing, you know, kung fu.
sorry, tea went up my nose. But you were filming kung fu, or you were doing the kung fu?
No, I wasn't doing kung fu. I was filming somebody doing kung fu. But you know, doing the classic sort of 70s, 60s sort of
mustache stuntman kind.
Yes, hey, yeah, and so snap zooms. So, but apart that would probably be the only time I've zoomed in ages. So yeah, you definitely these are really more sort of variable primes.
I mean, occasionally, I'm thinking we've done some creep zooms.
Yes.
But almost as often as not, when it comes to creep zooms, we've done them in post because you're never quite sure the timing of them. And as they're creeps, you know you can pull them off in post, even more so with a Red.
Yeah. Look, anytime I sort of want to do a sort of a creep, I'd sort of rather just lay a track and do a dolly. Or sometimes you'll put a zoom on a crane if you're doing a whole bunch of you know crane work. But essentially, you'll put it on there just so that you don't have to change lenses all the time. And if you are doing a shot where you want to start really wide, you want to get in close, your crane can't quite make it. Or if you go so wide, you're going to see your tracks, and if you go so tight, you're going to run out of track. So you need to have that little bit of a zoom in that camera move to just give you that little bit more range. And on basically, you're zooming in that situation. You're trying to hide that zoom in the camera track, in the camera move. So really, you're not even trying to zoom at all. You're just trying to make your camera crane move look like a much bigger move than it was.
So if we then sort of consider these as good things to have as, like from your point of view as a director, as a you know variable sort of prime.
Yeah.
I guess the other thing then comes on pulling focus. Because now, help me out here, because obviously your background, but am I right in thinking that the gearing, or is that solved with the mods?
Well, it's helped. Obviously, film or cine lenses are designed to have, you know, two or three turns to go from infinity to, you know, 3 foot or whatever their minimum is. So they're designed to give you accuracy so that, you know, you don't have, if you tweak the lens one little millimeter, you're not going to go from, you know, 10 feet to 3 feet. They're geared and designed to to sort of give you a lot of range and a lot of control and a lot of accuracy. Having these lens, and what he does is he puts beautifully press fits this proper Delrin gear over the top of it, and it's like hex locked on. It's beautifully done, and you really need, I think, if you're going to use these Nikon, these stills lenses, you really need to have something that's got a little follow focus and a gear on it, because it just helps give you that little extra bit of accuracy. Because if you look at the sort of markings on some of these lenses, there's not a lot of travel between, you know, 6 feet and 4 feet or something, and putting a follow focus on is really just going to give you that little bit extra, particularly if you go for a really good follow focus. Some of them are two speed, you can actually pop a little button and they will actually lower the gearing and give you that little bit more control. I'm not really a big fan of those, but you can get them.
And so once I've got that gearing on, I can do the whole thing, including like the remote focus cable, so that I can, you know,
exactly.
Nothing's stopping me, right?
Yeah, exactly. It's standard. The gears are cut the standard pitch, the same pitch as, you know, any Arri or Zeiss. It's all the same gearing. So you can put any piece of rental camera control or follow focus or remote focus on these lenses. Look, this, you know, it's perfectly respectable. I think the main thing is that what this does is you can buy your Red for, you know, $20,000. You can buy your lens, a whole kit of lenses for $3,500, and, you know, it's going to fit in two Pelican cases and off you go. I think there's obviously there's plenty of people out there who are doing nature and doco and all that sort of stuff.
But also they're quite fast, right? I mean, let's not deny it. Like one of the problems we've got, not a problem, but, you know, like one of the things that we fight against is with zooms and stuff, is you just tend to get them being, you know, got 2.8 or 3.
Yeah.
But some of the primes and stuff that we're talking about with the Nikon, they're like 1.4.
Yeah, he's got two sets. There's a 5 set. Of course, they'll be all sold out, of course, now after this podcast, just once this gets out there. Yeah. But he's got, a 1.4.
When you say he, you're referring to the company that...
Jim Sundberg, who's the guy, RP Lens, R for Robert, P for Peter, lens.com, is the guy who does it. He sources all the lenses, cleans them up, and builds these kits and put them in a Pelican case. So there's a 1.4, like 35mm 1.4, 50mm 1.2, 85mm 1.4. So there's a high-speed set and there's a standard-speed set. So and I think he's also got a couple of zooms that he does as well. But no, I think it's a really great option.
Yeah. I guess.
And now there's obviously a Nikon mount. How much is the mount though?
Good question. Actually, it's not that expensive, because I think what happened is that they were going to engineer a really super cool, expensive Nikon mount.
Yeah.
And then what happened is that somebody, it may be PS Technicas, but somebody came out with a good lens mount, and the lens mount was actually pretty much a simpler version. So the Nikon mount that Red came out with, which I'm pretty sure is about $500 US,
yeah,
is just a simplified version of what they were intending to do.
Very now, simple.
The B4 to PL adapter, which is a whole different ballgame, is the one that actually has optics involved in it and is quite complicated, and it's like $3,500. Yeah. But just the Nikon mount, you know, it just isn't that much. And it isn't, as I say, just up to Red, because you can get, there's a whole PS Technica rig that we saw at NAB that has a whole range of mounts. Now,
their stuff is, I'm not sure how much that costs, but their stuff is notoriously, you know, it's beautifully made, but it's notoriously expensive. And that, I think that's a kit with a whole bunch of...
Yeah, but you got to think what you're saving on.
The good thing
lenses.
About it is you can go, they do have a Panavision mount.
That's true, but don't you, do you know what I mean? Like you're saving a lot of money on the lenses, right? So if you are paying a little bit extra for the mount, that's money you're going to see back in a package, right? Because the cheapest lens that, look, and I, you know, not trying to talk people out of it, the cheapest lens that you can possibly buy from Red is going to be $6,500, right?
Yeah.
So even if it costs you a grand for a mount, you know, you're still going to be ahead on a $3,000 package of zooms and stuff. And also the primes for Red aren't shipping yet.
Yeah.
So
the people who are really going to care about lens prices are the people who are going to be really interested in this. There's a lot, obviously, a great user base of the Red is the indie film market, and
yeah, I think it's really valid.
Own your lenses.
Well, yeah, exactly. Owning your lenses. I mean, owning that means of production is something that Stu DV Rebel, who does stuff with us in PhD,
yeah,
it's a big point that he says is, you know, owning the means of production. It's one of his sort of tenets of the DV Rebel philosophy.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really hard to own a stack of primes and a stack of zoom lenses, even at the great prices that Red come in at.
Yeah.
Now, if you don't want to go with Nikon lenses, I mean, there's nothing wrong with renting and stuff, but it's just nice to have that option, I think. And especially, you know, when you consider that a lot of these lenses that they're talking about, the ones that, you know, you referred to as being repurposed from being, you know, by...
RP lens.
By RP lens, by, yeah. These are really good lenses, but there is this whole move to the sort of digital cameras, different sensors, blah, blah, blah. So a bunch of camera lenses that were particularly good kind of got overrun by the adoption of some of the digital stuff. So you've got great lens, not so relevant in the stills market anymore.
Mm.
And so it doesn't even cost that much to buy these on eBay, though, as you pointed out, RP Lens does their own checking on them.
I know there's a big demand for a lot of people asking for a Canon mount. I guess they'll do that at some stage because this guy, obviously, he does he repurposes Canons as well.
Other than just Red, of course, he does.
Lenses are... I've heard it from two or three people now that there's such demand for good lenses now, obviously, because these cameras are coming out, and also because people are... you've got all the 35, not just Red, but you've got 35mm adapters, you know, the Red Rock sort of micro kind of stuff.
Yep.
Lenses and lens kits like expensive Cook S4s are actually disappearing. People are renting them and stealing them, and there's a big market now for
renting and stealing.
There's a lot of big glass going missing.
You want to buy lens? That's right. Lens.
So scour those eBay listings, guys.
It's good. It's clean. Okay. So
and
now,
also, sorry, just to touch on that. Red will ship your camera with a Nikon mount if you want.
Oh, so it's like factory fitted?
Yeah, that's right.
Oh, that's cool.
And
how'd you find that out?
I don't know. Red will ship your camera. I'm sure this is straight up. Red will ship your camera with a Nikon mount installed at your request at no charge. If you wish to send your camera in and you have a PL mount, you can have it replaced for a Nikon mount. So that they'll swap your mount over for free. I presume they.
The perky people at Red.
Absolutely. So they'll swap one over, or they'll ship it to you. If you only want Nikon mount, let them know because they can get you one.
Yes. Yes. Have I asked you already? You're a Nikon guy, right? Not a Canon guy.
Nikon guy just by, but, you know, every time I pick up someone's Canon, I go, oh, this is cool.
Yeah, there's a few divisions in the world, and that's one of them.
Certainly is. It's
right up there with PC and Mac and 110 versus 230 volt and powered NTSC. Yeah. Though, what I'm really keen to get onto is your chat about this opencut.org project.
Yeah, look, it was, as soon as I saw it, I thought, oh, this is fantastic. A director basically approached Silverado and, well, anyway, I'll let Tori and the guys from Silverado take us through the program, and then we can have a chat about it on the other side. Okay, I'm talking to Tori Loomis and Erica Sparrow from Silverado Systems. Hey guys, thanks for taking time to have a chat.
Thanks, Jason. It's nice to be with you.
Yeah, nice to meet you, Jason.
Okay, well, I'll touch on the open cut competition in a minute, but for those that don't know, give us the Silverado story.
Sure, I'll grab that one. Silverado Systems started out just as a small consultant for Max, and we primarily started working mostly with graphic designers and filmmakers, and pretty much got steered towards being an Apple Pro reseller by Apple. And we've almost doubled our growth ever since. We now are offering things to clients like NASA. We have clients like Pixel Brothers in Chicago that work for Jerry Springer and NBC Universal. And it all stemmed because, you know, the Mac is very centric to design and video. And that's when we decided to focus on that aspect, our business totally grew.
Right.
So Apple Edit Systems, HD Edit Systems, and then when the Red cameras came out, we jumped on that as soon as we could, and now we're working with Assimilate and selling Scratch systems as well.
Oh, well, obviously there's a really strong link between Red and Apple, but what else drew you to Red?
A lot of the folks that I knew who were getting very interested in the Red project, I knew they weren't going to do it because it was a hoax or anything. People like Mike Curtis from HD for Indies, Ted Chilowitz, who at that time was still at AJA.
Yeah.
These guys, you know, they're not going to abandon their current jobs and their current endeavors in order to get on with something that was a hoax. So when they started talking about the project being very serious, and being able to do 2K and 4K in the manner which Jim Jannard had mentioned, I thought it was a no-brainer that this was sort of a natural path where people have come from DV and they're going to HD and now they're going to 2K and 4K. I thought it was a natural path and that we would want to be on the forefront of that.
Yeah, and it's still growing. We're still on the bleeding edge of it all.
Absolutely.
So take us through how the concept of OpenCut came about.
Sure. You know, I don't know if I wouldn't have come up with it. I think it probably would have come out eventually. I got the idea from seeing a couple clips on YouTube. You know, there's a clip called Scary Mary where they took Mary Poppins and they recut it as a horror movie trailer. And then they took something from The Shining and they recut that into a family feel-good type movie. And I thought, you know, that really does show the power of editing. You can take any kind of material and you can re-edit it and make something so completely different.
Yeah.
So I thought, you know, that would be really cool if someone was to open up, you know, a short feature or a commercial or a documentary down the road where you would let not just one or two people edit it, but you let an entire community edit it. I didn't pay much more attention until Evan Nicholas decided he wanted to shoot Susanna on the Red Cam, and because of the nature of the project, it was a short subject, shot on Red, so your data files aren't monstrous. I thought to myself, you know, we could actually launch this and do this, and so we went ahead with it, and I talked to Evan about it, and he was actually planning on just doing a director's cut and submitting it on his own, but when I laid it out for him, and he talked to a few people, they said, I mean, you'd be crazy not to do this. This is a fantastic opportunity.
Yeah.
And right now, we're up to about 240 entries. So I don't think even – I thought maybe we'd get 30 or 40.
Yeah.
And I would have been thrilled with that.
And it's not over yet.
No, not at all. We're still getting entries, and our office is filling up with hard drives. So yeah. Yeah,
it's a mammoth project you guys have undertaken. I obviously didn't realize how big it would be and how big it may still get.
Well, and that's the really cool thing. You know, as sort of the premise gets around, I think people are starting to realize the idea behind taking a project and distilling it to hundreds of people, and then in a competition based setting, you're going to wind up with a project that could be 10 times better than if you had, say, edited it yourself.
Oh, absolutely.
Everyone has a particular bias. Some people like a dramatic feel. Some people like a more active feel. Some people, you know, lay on the suspense, and some people just make it a real straight cut. When you take material and you give it to everyone, you're going to see how people treat that material. And I think people, including the director, Evan, he might be surprised at how his own project comes out. He may find that a particular submission that he really likes took the project in a completely different way, and it just happens to work better than all the others.
Oh, look, I can imagine it'd be fantastic as a director to get hundreds of different interpretations of your project, all of them probably really different. And it's probably, as an editor, it's probably a really freeing exercise as well, too, not having a director telling you what to do.
Absolutely. Yeah, what I think is kind of cool, and also kind of surprising, is that that Evan didn't really give any direction or instruction of, you know, what his vision, you know, for the film should be, and that he really is letting everybody interpret it, you know, however they feel it should be told.
Yeah, well, I guess the less brief you give people, the more interesting and varied the results you're going to end up with. You know, let this concept work for you, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, we're going to be giving everyone the storyboards and the script as they were developed and how the particular project was shot. However, if you want to reverse the story and maybe tell it from beginning or from end to beginning, if you want to go nonlinear, if you want to tell it in a different way, as long as I think if it respects the director's vision, you can have your way with the edit.
Yeah. Okay. Well, can you take us through how it works for somebody who wants to enter, what the costs are, and how they get the footage and how they get it back to you?
Absolutely. It's actually really straightforward, and I would hope that we've made it fairly inexpensive for people to do. You go to opencut.org, and there's an entry page. You submit your entry, and you go through PayPal and pay $25. At that point, we send you a set of instructions on where to send your hard drive. The material is about 170 gigabytes of audio, video, and along with the script and the storyboard. And a lot of people have asked, well, can't I just download that? And that's just not practical at this time to have 200 people download 170 gigabytes worth of material each. It may get down to the point where we have a partner who wants to put that up on a BitTorrent site of some sort, but that's a tremendous amount of bandwidth. And so at this time, sending us a small hard drive is still the most practical way to go. So they'll send us a hard drive, we'll load it up for them, and then we actually keep the hard drives here, because what's going to happen is the hard drives are all going to be sent back out via U.S. Postal Service two-day priority mail. So it's a very democratic way of returning all the hard drives to everyone all at the same time. You know, if we get all of these things out at the same time, any delays in you getting the drive back is not due to us.
Yeah.
And so we're basically trying to treat people as fairly as possible by getting them the exact same amount of time to do their cut. The only difference is international entrance. This is an international project. If people want to enter from abroad, that's open to them 100%. We will take their hard drives and send those back early, because we know that there's a customs process that's going to have to go through that might delay them getting their drives back a day or two. So we will be sending those back probably 2 days earlier than the domestic entries. And then because of the shipping charges and whatnot, there is an additional shipping charge for international entries, but it's not totally unreasonable.
And all of this falls to you, Eric.
It actually does. I'm staring at a big pile of boxes right now. And actually, getting back to the whole international thing, some people are opting to purchase hard drives through us, and we ship the hard drives directly to them instead of having to deal with shipping on their end.
Okay.
But it is sort of daunting from like a data management point of view. I mean, like Tori said, we weren't expecting as many participants, but I mean, we are actually, are pleasantly surprised that so many people are jumping on board. And, it just means that we're going to have to be a little more organized with how we deal with moving all this media onto these drives. But we have several dedicated workstations with disk images of the project. And, we're accepting all types of drives. So any connection, even bare drives, we'll take and put media on it and send it back to them.
Well, you guys are just the guys to do it. You're totally set up for that kind of stuff, I guess.
We're really pretty well set up. Through Silverado Systems, we're dealers for Apple and Panasonic and things like that. We've over the years, as dealers, you accrue a lot of demo equipment. So we have quite a stockpile of Macs, displays, workstations, and whatnot. So we have an ample supply of places that we can pull from. When Eric came on, Silverado Studios was born because we didn't want $150,000 demo room to sort of sit idle when clients were walking in. Eric joined us to help head up our Red rental department and our Red post department, and so he's an integral part. Even though they're separate divisions, they work hand in hand together, and on this project it really works well together.
Well, I guess it's probably no surprise, I suppose, with hindsight, that this is going to be a really popular idea, because I don't think there's anything been like this before. I can't think of any sort of project like this that's ever occurred.
No, I mean, there are sites like Red Relay where you can download, a clip or two, that people have shot just to sort of test out. And, and we've also sent out, like four DVD sets of footage. But
yeah, I know, I got
nothing
one.
But nothing that really tells a story. I mean, you can learn the workflow and the process, but not in the context of an actual like edit session. So you're right. I mean, this is sort of like a first.
Oh, absolutely, it's a huge first. It's going to be a great educational tool for a lot of people, and let's not forget, there's a pretty impressive prize at the end there too.
But yeah, that's probably a good thing to mention. We're donating an IOHD from AJA. Which we think is a pretty good prize for any editor. But some other folks of us, they've stepped up as well, and they've added some really cool things. We're going to be submitting Susanna as a finished project. The winning editor is going to become the editor of record at Susanna's spot on IMDb. That's something that Evan has made 100% possible. It's not going to be something that he takes your edit and then has someone else online and they give someone else the credit. But the person who's actually getting the credit is the editor who's entered into OpenCut, and they'll become the editor of record. Assimilate has stepped up, and they are going to be taking the winning sequence, and they're going to be conforming it to 4K. And then we're very thrilled to have Cube Cinema just recently signed on board as a sponsor. They're going to be taking the 4K master, and they're going to be creating a digital cinema package, which is DCI compliant. So that's you know, a tremendous amount of resources being thrown at one particular project. The end result is that we're going to take Susanna and we're going to submit it to multiple film festivals throughout the country and see how it happens. So it's taking a community project and distilling it into the absolute best result, and then redistributing it back to the community for their own review at film festivals throughout the world.
Fantastic. And Evan Nicholas, the director, he must be rapt.
I think he's pretty stunned at how this has totally taken off. And I had an idea that, you know, this would be a fairly popular thing with a lot of people. And I communicated the same to him. I think that's probably why he wanted to get on board with it. But both of us are pretty stunned at the initial outpouring of warm comments, and people are really excited. I mean, people have called it, you know, the best idea on the internet so far, and blah blah blah. And people have said some really cool things about the particular project, and we're really happy to see all the comments.
Oh, there's this one thing I also wanted to mention before it slipped my mind, is that you know, there are a lot of great prizes and a lot of people stepping up and, you know, throwing stuff into the mix. But I think one major benefit of this whole project is, you know, just getting your hands on the footage and learning how to deal with, you know, Red editorial, and, you know, trying to find the workflow that works for you.
Yeah, look, I ordered your Red footage DVDs because at the time there really was no other way to get your hands on Red files to play with.
And this particular project, I believe, was shot with Build 13. So there is no audio in the R3D files. It was the audio was captured separately. So I mean, you know, you will have to sync audio. You will get those audio files, you know, along with the storyboards and script and all that stuff. So I mean, it really is going to be a thorough editorial process.
Sure. Okay. So what's next for OpenCut?
We have a lot of different possibilities. This first was sort of a natural one for get out the gate, to do a short subject, something that would get a lot of attention. We have a lot of other material that have either shot or are in the process of going to shoot. We just did a big shoot up at Alpine Meadows, which is a ski resort up in Lake Tahoe, and I know that the folks at Alpine Meadows were just thrilled to have us up there to shoot some of the stuff, you know, especially with the fact that we're using 120 frames a second on 2K and shooting in their snowboard park. Really, there are some amazing shots that have come out of that, and I know that they would be open to having an open cut type commercial shot and probably used on the web or on TV from that particular material. So the next go around might be a spec commercial that's requested by Alpine Meadows, and the winning cut would have their 30 or 60 second commercial debuted on local television in Northern California and probably on the Alpine Meadows website.
Fantastic, because again, I guess that's part of learning just another one of those disciplines, getting story down, getting something done in 30 seconds or a limited time frame, not quite so unrestricted as something like Susanna.
Exactly.
Yeah. But there are also other things too, that, you know, like music videos or effects intensive projects. I think each new open cut project we take or we start, might have a certain emphasis, you know, to it. Like, you know, like if it focuses on green screen or motion tracking, match moving, that kind of stuff, You know, that might be one project, or, you know, music videos, you know, performance based, or, you know, narrative, or a mix of the two, or, you know, something. But yeah, you know, I mean, there's lots of things that we've been kicking around.
Oh, look, it's a fantastic project. I hope it really works for you. Just go over the closing dates once more and where people can go to enter.
Sure. We're accepting entries now at opencut.org. Go on there, and there's a big button at the top that says enter. We're accepting entries probably throughout the first week of June. The faster you get us the hard drive, the faster we're going to turn it around and get it back out to you. We anticipate returning drives around March 27th and 28th to domestic, and a little bit earlier for international. We're not going to restrict people from submitting. I'm sorry?
You said March.
Oh, did I say March? I said I should have said May. May 27th, 28th. We're not going to restrict entries from being accepted. If you get us a hard drive throughout the first week of June, we'll still put all the material onto it and get it right back to you. But most people are going to have their hard drives by the last day of May or the first day of June, and that'll give them a full 30 days to complete the cut. And delivery is going to be online to a file sharing site called Views. We're very happy that Views, it's V-U-Z-E, Views has signed on as a sponsor of OpenCut. They're going to be accepting H.264 copies, either in 720 or 1080.
Fantastic. And what's the sort of the criteria for judging? Who's involved in that? And
oh, that's a good question. And I should probably talk about the executive producer a little bit as well. Evan Nicholas is the right-hand man of Joe Carnahan, who was involved with shooting. As director, he shot Smoke and Aces. He shot Narc.
Yeah.
And he's his forthcoming project is Killing Pablo, which is set to start shooting either this year or next year in South America. Joe Carnahan is also the director of the really well done Cadillac spots that you're seeing on TV these days. They've been extraordinarily well received. It's about the most successful Cadillac series that GM has ever put on. So Evan is Evan's Joe's assistant, and this is his directorial debut. Joe was very generous and pretty much executive produced by giving all the costs for the crew and the Southern California gear rentals that were needed. We contributed the camera. We also contributed some crew members. I basically volunteered them. We have a couple of really, really, we have some really good crew up here who know a lot about Red. One of the best shooters is Brian Hamm. He's just this phenomenal DP up here who's just got a work ethic like you've never seen. And I think he had our camera 2 days after we got back, and he was already shooting with it. He'd never touched the thing before. He figured it out, and within 96 hours, they had turned around Paranoid, which was one of the first projects released on the net. Did a fantastic job, not even working with that project yet. So that was, Susanna was shot a few months after Paranoid, and by that time he had already done a couple other projects with the Red, and so it really had a lot of experience with it. And he was, the digital media technician was Ryan Todd, who as of now is now a full feature film director on Censored, which a Robert Picardo picture that was shot in February. And if you guys don't know Robert Picardo, he's a very well-known American actor in Stargate series. And
it's quite a jump from DMT to director.
Absolutely. These guys are workers. They know their stuff. They know their craft. And so now they're in the midst of editing Censored. That should be done by the end of the summer. But those guys had some time on their hands before the feature filming started for Censored, so we flew them down. Silverado helped facilitate that and the cameras, and then just basically wrapped it all together with Evan's hard work on the script, and got the project done.
Oh, well, good on you for pulling it all together. It's a fantastic effort. I'm sure Evan's wrapped with it all, and this will be a great move for him.
It was a big collaborative effort.
But of course, this works both ways. As the editors involved, I think, can use it for their benefit as well.
Well, one of the things that we're allowing, because of the licensing, we're allowing anyone who participates in OpenCut to use the Susanna entry, their own Susanna entry, as part of their reel. So we encourage anyone who enters, even just for the sake of improving their craft, you'll get your entire cut, and we're fully letting people use that on their reel, and you can show it to people, you can send it to people, you can put it on their website. It's your own cut, and as long as it's used non-commercially for your own promotion, self-promotion of your editing skills, we want to make sure that's available to everyone who participates.
Right, well, thanks guys for taking the time to chat today. I really appreciate it. How can people find you?
They can go to OpenCut at www.opencut.org. You can go to Silverado Systems' website if they want an Apple system, or if they want an Assimilate Scratch system. They can find that at silverado.cc. And then Eric's site, which is our Silverado Studios site, can be found at silveradostudios.tv.
All right. Well, thanks for that, guys. That's terrific. Good luck with it. And we'll catch up with you again maybe at the other end of this.
Fabulous, Jason. We'll talk to you soon.
Okay, thanks, Jason.
Thanks, guys.
So Jess, that was great. Let me just double check. So I would send them a drive?
You send them a drive.
They will buy a drive for me, or...?
Both.
Okay.
I'm not sure the prices of the buying yet. There are people who will choose to just say, hey, sell me a drive with the footage on it. And I think if you have your own drive, it's $25. You FedEx them your drive, they'll load it up, send it back to you. And then I think you, from what I can understand, you FTP your cut back to them. But they've really got it sorted. It's a brilliant idea, and I think it sounds like it's really gathering some momentum. When I spoke to them a week ago before the interview, they had like 140 people signed up. And when I spoke to them yesterday, they, as you mentioned in the interview, they got 250 or so people now. So it's a really interesting program, and obviously it's not going to stop here.
Right. And so, again, it's got to be returned because it's the month of June that it's basically running. Is that right?
Yeah.
Okay. And I guess the thing is, we can check back in with them closer to the deadline to see where that's up to.
Yeah, I said I'd catch up with them on the flip side of that, but yeah, maybe I'll touch base with them in the next few sort of weeks when it closes up, and yeah, sort of see when after the closing date comes and goes. I guess I'll find out where did they get, how many did they get.
Yeah, because it would be really interesting to know, and I guess I'm curious to know how many they sent out versus how many they got back in. You know what I mean? Because some people were just saying, oh, this seems like a really great way of getting a ton of footage.
Yes, get the footage. That's right.
For not much money. Okay, well, again, so then we're going to discuss, because we would normally at this point in the proceedings say we will put the link to opencut.org in the show notes. But we have show note information, which is, I know it sounds like we're looking at our own navel, but hang in there for the quiz question of the week, which is coming up in 1 second. But before we get to that, let's just explain what we've done to improve. During the break, we've been working hard. We've had teams of trained, you know, Uber geeks working on the site, and they've abseiled into the problem of making it easier for you guys in terms of what's going on. So when you go to fxguide.com, there is three things that you need to, be good to know. On the front page, there'll always be under the section that has on the right, you know, FX Guide TV and FX Podcast, there'll be what is the latest Red Center. And that's in a little black panel on the right, halfway down the screen. Can't miss it. We normally also will stick something in quick take, so you may miss the quick take simply because it's moved off the screen. So to help you with that, what we've done is we've actually added to our forums a whole section on Red Center. So if you go to the forums button and click on that, you'll be taken to FX Guide's forums, and there is a whole page devoted to just Red Center. And the first person to post in that Red Center forum was, in fact, somebody that I know quite well. That was you.
It was me. Was it?
But somebody's already replied to you. So, actually, that was John, I think. But anyway,
yes, it was
the
John
point
saying
is that,
here it is.
That we've got our own forum. And then the other thing is, if you go under knowledge on the FX Guide forum, you will see Red Center Podcast, because that's where we put all our podcasts, FX Guide TV, FX Podcast. and right there is Red Center Podcast. And this is significant because at www.fxguide.com/redcenter, spelled R-E-D-C-E-N-T-R-E, yep, as our English ancestors would like us to spell it, not only can you download any of the podcasts done to date, but we now have downloadable show notes. Now, why go to downloadable PDF show notes? I alluded to this earlier. It's simply so we can put more in the show notes, including things such as photos. And obviously, dealing with a camera, it'd be nice to be able to have photos of some of the things we're talking about.
Yeah, and links to all the gear and to the people we've talked to. And yeah, so there'll be a lot in there for this episode once it comes out.
So that show note, if you click on it, will just take you to a PDF. It may be a simple PDF that just has a link of, like, for example, last week's one had just, I think, a few links in it. Or it could be a more complicated one, such as in this week, which will have all the photos of the Nikon mount in action. So that's great. Now, I do want to... I joked at the beginning of the podcast about the feedback we'd be getting, and in fact, we got a ton of feedback. Probably the most popular one we've done so far, Jason, I'd say, would be episode 4, our interview with Graham Natras.
Yeah, look, I guess that sort of goes to show the power of geekdom out there, the throngs of tech heads.
Well, okay, or you could have just said, "Hey, Mike, that was a good interview."
It was a fantastic interview.
That's fine. I'll go
interview
with the throngs of geekdom, neck tech, whatever you said.
But some of it may have gone over my head, or
yeah,
not.
Yeah, well, all right.
But it was good. It's all in it. I'm learning as I go. I'll tell you, there's been a lot of interesting sort of stuff. Even the Panavision, the recent Panavision videos, some of that sunk in. It's all good. Education is an excellent thing.
It's true, but you know what? I mean, I think I'm, you know, genuinely interested to hear you talking to filmmakers as well, and I know that you have more interviews coming up with actual filmmakers.
Indeed, yep. Well, people like the interviews. It's obviously want less of us talking and more of other people. So, no, it's good. No, it's great. I like getting out there interviewing people. It's fantastic.
Well, I think the fact of the matter is that nothing speaks volumes are louder than, or nothing speaks louder than just having the person that's actually doing it. So, I mean, my thing about that Nikon thing was I just wanted to speak to someone that's actually using it in the field, as opposed to looking at it at the trade show, which I did, and then not really being able to judge what it's like in action, in anger. Because, quite frankly, I wouldn't want to go into battle on some of that new stuff until I'd spoken to a few people that had done some stuff.
Exactly, and like probably most of the gear that I'd sort of mention here too is all sort of stuff that I've seen on Red User and people who have actually used it and bought it and said, wow, this is cool, I've got one of these that I think they're fantastic. So, we want to sort of talk about stuff we...
Now, our downloads have been going through the roof since we've developed this. It really took off after week 3. So if you've got something that you'd like us to discuss, feel free to either send us a review copy, a link, or just email us with what's going on. And, of course, if you would like to just send in a shout-out, do that. However, you probably want to do a combination of both that and answering this week's killer question.
Right, which is, before R3D files were called R3D files, what were they called?
So, dot, three
you translate
letters.
That, Michael.
That's your hint. Okay.
Dot R3D
so the answer
files.
Dot what R3D is wrong. That was whatever they were called before that. And if you email us at
red@fxguide.com.
Thank you. And you say that again slower.
red@fxguide.com.
Okay, and we're going to take the 10th correct answer, okay, to be super, super fair to everyone and all and sundry. So if you're hearing this podcast and you went, oh, I didn't see that go up, God, somebody's probably already answered it already. No, they may have answered already. You just have to be the 10th one that we get to. And
exactly,
as we did last week to Brian, who, congratulations, his prize actually wrapped in a FX PhD T-shirt was sent out to him.
Cool.
Then that was just like a bonus prize. Then we'll send it out to you. And I think that's about it for this week.
Yeah, look, I think we've crammed a lot in. It's good. We'll try and keep it up.
So we'll be covering more stuff in coming weeks, including talking to more filmmakers, the latest builds, details on 16, some of the stuff to do with low noise response curves and how things have improved, and especially any changes in the ISO. All of that coming up and more. Please check out the website, the new downloads, and again, we do seriously appreciate you guys listening. The only reason that we do this is because of the feedback we get from you guys.
Absolutely.
So the whole point of this is the community and the professional community, not the hysterical Looney Tune fringe. So we do. No, seriously, you guys are like why we're in it. So so thanks so much, guys. We really appreciate it. And thanks to all the people that came up at both the Sydney and the New Zealand event saying how much they enjoyed the podcast. And
That was great. We'd had a week of some interesting comments on the board, so it was nice to get there and have some people saying some wonderful things.
I think people were doing the whole, so you're the Jason kind of thing, which was great.
No, it was great. It was good to meet you all. Thank you.
Talk to you next week. Goodbye, guys.
Cheers.
Thanks for listening. If you have any questions or comments, please email us red@fxguide.com. Copyright 2008 FX Guide LLC.